Welcome into the Cultural Coven. I'm your host, Nicola Roy. I hope everything's as well as it can be in your world. It's a bit of a grey and stormy day here in Edinburgh, but it's lovely to have a bit of positive news in the world of Scottish theatre, which is that some restrictions are easing and theatres are slowly reopening, and long may it continue. And I'm actually going to be back in the rehearsal room in a couple of weeks doing a lovely play called The Gardener by Ed Robson, featuring the brilliant actor Crawford Logan. It's very much Crawford's character's story, a beautiful tale about the cycle of life. We did do this play around 4 years ago, and it was named the Times newspaper's Play of the Year. And honestly, Crawford's performance is exquisite. It's well worth catching. So if you fancy seeing a bit of theatre, we open at the Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh in early March, and then we'll be touring around Scotland. So it'll be lovely to see some friendly faces in the audience. I'd also like to give a shout out to The Crush Bar. It's a weekly newsletter about theatre written by Fergus Morgan, a journalist and theatre critic, and each issue features an exciting and emerging theatre maker. It gives them a real chance to be explicit about where they want to go with their career and what help they need to get there. And it's a great way of keeping in touch with who's new on the scene. Crush Bar is totally free, so why not subscribe to the newsletter from their website at www.thecrushbar.substack.com so you never miss an issue. Okay, on to this week's episode, and what an inspiring and brilliant guest we have for you this week. A young woman who has made a huge mark on the Scottish poetry scene. She won Scots Speaker of the Year in 2021. She's a Scots language and mental health advocate. She's also Poet Laureate of the St Andrews Society of Los Angeles 2020. She does Scots Word of the Day on her vast social media platforms, something she started in lockdown. That's right, it is the wonderful Len Penny. I am just full of admiration for Len, her writing talent, and the way in which she uses her vast platforms to be an advocate and bring a voice to so many causes that need it. Here we talk about her poetry style, her work, Scottish identity, Scots as a language, online dating, trolling, misogyny, and trigger warning, we do talk about her mental health battles at length and suicidal thoughts. An important conversation to have, but I do want to give you a warning around that. A very inspiring, honest and interesting chat. If you're enjoying the conversation, as always, please do remember to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and please do leave us a wee review on iTunes. It would really help other people find the Coven. And also, why not follow us on our socials at Cultural Coven on Twitter and Cultural Coven Pod on Instagram. Enjoy. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre. So hi Len, and welcome into the Cultural Coven. I am so excited to be getting the chance to chat to you today. How are you and where are you in the world?
Hello, I'm really excited to be here. I am currently in the Central Belt. I'm home for the holidays with my family, so I'm finally able to relax.
Oh, lovely. It's not too long till Christmas now, is it? I'm feeling very confused. No. Although when this episode goes out, it will be around Valentine's Day. So that's a whole other chat there. So Len, you are a Scottish poet and a Scots language and mental health advocate. You are Scots Performer of the Year 2021 and social media person of growing increase, as during 2020 in this hellish COVID pandemic, you started posting your Scots Word of the Day and the world started lapping it up. When you first started posting, did you, in your wildest dreams, imagine you would gain the profile and praise that you have?
Absolutely not. I started the Word of the Day. I thought it'd be a couple of weeks, if that, just to get me out of bed, get me doing something in the middle of lockdown. And then immediately when people started liking it, I was like, oh God, I've got to keep this going. And it's been I've just celebrated 530 days. So,
wow. Yeah. Has there ever been a day that you've nearly missed it or forgotten?
Yes, but it's only because I used to work in a kitchen. I was a chef, and you have to wake up for like a prep shift, and you know, I'd have to get the bus in, so I'd have to wake up at 5:45 and get the word done, and there's nothing you want to be doing less at that time in the morning than being all bright and bubbly. So sometimes I'll be filming it and you can look back and see the ones where it was, and I'll be like, all right lads, it's cause where the day's day is purgled.
My voice has dropped an octave.
People will tell you if you look tired.
Oh, how charming. It's lovely. A lovely way. It's nice when people pay compliments like that, isn't it? It's really heartwarming.
Absolutely.
Stuff. I love the Scots word of the day. I feel like it's through work that I have a relatively good knowledge of Scots and have worked in Scots as an actor, but nothing like the vast knowledge you have. Do you just have all these words in your head, or do you have to sit and look them up?
That's the best thing about it, is it's a mixture of both. I mean, I was raised with a fairly comprehensive Scots vocabulary,
sure.
or so I thought, until I started doing more research, and the DSL online, the Dictionary of the Scots Language, has some words from all over the country. And the great thing about Scots is it is so dialectal in nature. You know, there's regional words, and there's words that evolve differently in different parts of the country. So the great thing is I can go on and find a whole host of words that, you know, have only been used in a very specific part of the
right.
country, and I just come on and tell people about them, and it's a great thing because it means that it's not just me, you know, lecturing to people. I'm learning with people. It feels a lot nicer.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? Because I think as artists, we always want to keep evolving and keep learning, because
mm-hmm.
it's not really a profession. You always feel like, yeah, tick box, that's me, achieved everything. It never feels like that.
Absolutely.
So tell me, Lane, you are also known as Miss Punny Penny, which I think is a pretty cool nickname. How did that come about then?
I used to, there was a sort of Reddit Twitter thing that was, you know, they would post screenshots from Reddit and everyone would jump to be the first person to come up with something witty or clever to say. And that's how I got started on Twitter, was from just, you know, people would have their insightful social commentary and I'd just come in with a pun. So, you know, if it was like my girlfriend, you know, shouted at me in a library, I'd be like, oh, you need to turn the page on that relationship, you know, start a new chapter in your life. So I'm just sitting there coming, and it would be, you'd have to get it up within 30 seconds, otherwise no one would see it because of just the sheer volume of people.
Wow.
So I just had to come up, get quick. It was so much fun. I don't do it anymore, but I'd have notifications on my phone. I'd be obsessed with it. No matter what I'm doing, I'd be on the bus, at work, I'd have to reply to it. So yeah, there are people, you know, someone, it wasn't even me that came up with Miss Punny Penny. Someone commented on it because I used to go by just Penny, that's my second name. And they were like, you know, then from then on, it, people just expected the puns. And I got that from my dad because he is just the absolute dad of dad jokes. Like all of my pattern is stolen.
I mean, everything's come before, you know what I mean? There's nothing new, really. You just got to put your own spin on it. As I mentioned, you won Scots Performer of the Year 2021, mm-hmm. so congratulations, what a brilliant achievement. You were also Poet Laureate of St Andrew's Society in Los Angeles. So how did that come about then?
So there's a massive, massive Scottish connection with a load of places in America.
Yes.
And the St Andrew's Society of Los Angeles is one of the chapters of that. They have a massive affinity with Scottish culture. And they really do, they try and promote and protect Scottish culture as much as they can. So they give grants to Scottish artists and they invest in the sort of Scottish artistic scene. And they approached me and wanted me to write a poem for them. So that was, it's got nothing to do with that. That was one of my first commissioned pieces. And they liked it so much that they said they were creating a position for Poet Laureate and would I like to do it? And I said, absolutely, I think that's amazing. And I'm excited to see the people that come after me, more so than I am for my own. I mean, obviously, I know who I am, but I really want to see, you know, in a couple of years' time, if we can get some more, especially young female Scottish voices in the poetry scene, because I feel like that's kind of the thing we need to invest in now.
Yeah, that's really interesting because I'm very good friends with Liz Lockhead. And obviously, she came through at a different time, a time that was very much dominated by male poets and male playwrights, and obviously you're making a mark and it's brilliant. People are learning about who you are, but there still does feel like there's a real lack of female voices Who would you like to see come after you then as the poet laureate of that society?
It's tricky because I don't want to typecast anyone. I don't want to say, oh, I want someone to get it purely based on the value of them being a woman.
Sure.
But at the same time, as you say, in the Scottish artistic scene, and predominantly for me, as far as I'm concerned, the Scots scene, you're obviously following in the footsteps of women like Liz and, you know, Jackie Kay, and then the current Macker. But at the same time, you know, you're living in the legacy of Burns, you're living in the legacy of Sir Walter Scott, you're living in the legacy of these great, you know, and I say great in quotes, based on their, you know, their life and the way they lived.
Yes.
Certainly as far as Burns is concerned, these men. And it is, you feel very much like you're walking in the shadow. And I'd love to see, that's why I'm so interested in doing work with schools and getting my poetry in schools and working with the Waynes, because I really want to see a new generation of girls who can express themselves authentically. Because, yeah, there's great female poets, but there's female poets who will sit at home thinking Scots and then come to do their writing, come to do their creative work, and see a market that is unfriendly to Scots-speaking women and will just, you know, write their stuff in English. That's not to say that stuff in Scots has any more artistic merit, but it's a shame that they're not able to authentically express themselves the way that I feel that I can, you know?
I'd be interested to get your viewpoint on this. I see Scots as a language, not a dialect.
Absolutely. It's not even I've had so many discussions over the past, you know, year and a half, and it's stopped having any meaning, because with every point that's used to sort of refute the fact that it's a language, it becomes more and more laughable, because you know, it sort of, I think we had the head of linguistics at Oxford, Hamish Chalmers, he did a massive thread in support of me about a year ago. And I just keep linking the same one, because the points are still the same. There's no distinction between a language and a dialect that's not purely political. And if we count, people say, well, what's the point of having it as a language then? It's so we can protect and preserve the language.
Absolutely. You know? I've observed online people trying to politicise that point about it being a language.
I always say a celebration of one culture is not an attack on the other.
I mean,
there's people like to sort of demonise the unionists and say they're the ones that are anti-Scots, but it's not. It's a particular kind of person who is so fragile in their identity that they cannot fathom a world in which there's not a homogenous British identity. Now, I'm not saying that it's a nationalist thing. In fact, I am very careful to stay out of that debate entirely. Because I don't want my work to be politicised. I don't want my, you know, my language to be politicised. But at the same time, the opposition does tend to have a very political reason for doing so. When you see in articles that people write about me and things they choose to say in rebuttal to my points and things. And it's like, first of all, I don't know why they care so much. If they truly believe it to be a meaningless dialect, why is it causing them so much grief? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, can you not just get a bylight?
No, totally. I mean, also, and you made a really good point there. If we want to speak in our language, why does that necessarily have to be seen as an attack on anything else? It's not. And it also doesn't need to align itself with politics either, actually. It's just about, you know, celebrating who we are and where you're from and your culture, because why would we want that to die out? It's a beautiful, rich language.
Absolutely. It is, and I think there's an important distinction to be made in the fact that if you speak Scots or you speak Gaelic, because the Gaelic people are getting it all, but if you speak Scots or you speak Gaelic, you're no more Scottish than anyone
God
else.
No.
It doesn't make you. It's not a test of how Scottish you are. I mean, whether your first language is Gaelic or Urdu, you're equally as Scottish.
Absolutely.
It's purely just a sort of a recognition of a language people already use. I mean, I don't need permission to speak Scots. People say, oh, you're giving permission to other people to speak Scots. Nobody needs permission, least of all mine. They just need to feel that they're valid. And when you go into a school and you tell a Wayne that the way they speak is another language and they are in fact bilingual, and the fact that they spell things a different way, the fact that they tell their mum something different than what they would learn in the classroom, that's not a bad,
no,
you know, use of language. That's just a use of a different language.
Did you grow up speaking Scots in your house then?
Absolutely, yeah. It's nice because, you know, some some things that I'm learning and some words that I cover, I'll be like, wait, hang on, that's Scots? Because it's so baked into every aspect of life that you just think, wait, hang on, you don't use stoat, you don't use bringe, you don't use wheech. Like, these aren't just normal words.
Do you know why I love them? I think there's a lot of Scots words that are visceral or something, or there's nothing else that can quite replace it. They kind of just sound like what they are.
They make so much sense, whether that's because they're onomatopoeic, yeah. Whether that's because they're really, you know, syllabic, whatever that is, whatever linguistic, you know, little trickery you want to use, it means what it says, and there's no translation for some of it. Like, people always say, oh, what's your favourite word in Scots that doesn't exist in English? And I'm like, well, first of all, no Scots words exist in English, that's the point. But then there's words that physically you cannot use without using the Scots word. You can't use curry or wheech or bringe. It just evokes something within you that you're just like, how do I begin to articulate this in English?
Oh my goodness, yeah. You made a really good point there earlier about just because you might speak in Scots, it doesn't make you any more Scottish than somebody who doesn't, who lives here. And that's what I love about Scotland, particularly over the last 10 years or so, I would say, is I've really just observed as a country wanting to really open out to the world and welcome people here. And I just think that's to be celebrated. I think if you want to come here and you love Scotland, then we love you. Yeah, make it your home.
That's why it's so nice, because so many people who are in my comment sections or follow me, they aren't Scottish. Yeah. Or, you know, they are Scottish, but they weren't born here. They didn't grow up with Scots. So for me, that's really lovely, because it solidifies to me the fact that Scottish identity is such a nebulous thing. I think there's a meme that goes around, and it's the Scottish citizenship test, and it's, do you want to be Scottish? And then if yes, then you're Scottish, and if no, I do, start again. And it's nice, because, you know, I'm not denying the fact that there are problems in the country. Obviously, there's racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia, things that exist all over the world. But what I'm noticing in Scotland is an effort to try.
Yes, exactly.
To try and be better.
Exactly. Like you just said, no country is perfect. Can I talk to you about your style of poetry? So your style of poetry is a style that I am more familiar with, I suppose. I don't know if traditional form is the right term, but it's quite unyielding in structure, and it's in rhyming schemes. And rhyming, to me, is satisfying on the ear. I love it. And also poets such as Hannah Lavery that I know use a different free verse style, which I also enjoy. But what draws you to that style? Was it a conscious choice, or is that how you hear poetry and how you write?
I think I'm just an idiot in the sense that I study a lot of poetry. I do a literature degree.
Yes.
And I always have studied poetry extensively and critical analysis and stuff. And it never connected with me, because I was doing Burns at home I used to compete in Burns competition, and I'd study these rhyme schemes and these, you know, clever twists to make it fit. And that's the kind of poetry that resonated with me. And then I'd come to school and learn the poems that didn't rhyme, it felt very prosaic. It didn't connect with me. And I feel like a lot of people feel the same way, because one of the favourite comments that I get is, I don't usually like poetry, but I like yours. And I'm like, thank you, because I write poetry for myself, because not that anyone doesn't get poetry in Egypt, but I feel like I don't get it by virtue of being in Egypt, because I just couldn't fathom it. It didn't make sense. It didn't make me happy. And so I like to rhyme, because it feels, as you say, satisfying.
I have done some plays in rhyme on stage. So I was in Liz Lockhead's Educating Agnes and Tartuffe. And they all follow that rhyming, for me, very pleasing structure. And actually, it often makes it easier to learn, but it's a bugger if you drop a word, because then you're like, how do I make this rhyme? And I'm gonna mess this up for the next actor.
See, when you manage to find that rhyme, see, when you manage to find the right amount of syllables and a rhyme at the end, you're like, I'm a poet after all.
I imagine it's so satisfying. So often your work has a thread about Scottish identity, and you rightly highlight how Scottishness should not be equated to being white, for example. Is Scottish identity something that you want to highlight in your work?
Absolutely. And identity in general is something I want to highlight. I think through being actively online to a fault, I have come across all different kinds of opinions, and one of the ones I was coming into contact most frequently was from Americans who were talking about DNA.
Right.
They have Scottish DNA, mm-hmm. and they were using blood percentage to try and quantify their Scottishness. And immediately, that rubbed me up the wrong way, because I know people. I have so many friends who weren't born in Scotland but are just as Scottish as I am.
Yes.
And then people will always use the excuse, you know, how do you quantify Scottishness? Oh, both parents have to be born in Scotland. Well, that's me out then. My dad wasn't born in Scotland. So I'm very quick to, not to defend, because, you know, nobody needs my defence, but I'm very quick to highlight the fact that that's the wrong way to approach identity. You can't diminish or half identity when you marry someone of a different ethnic background. It doesn't make you any less Scottish. So that's why I like, but I also talk about identity in the sense that identities that relate to me, and whether that's, you know, LGBT rights, whether that's being a woman, whether that's, you know, something that directly affects me or things that affect people in my life very heavily. I'm very sure to push a message, because I think that to have any kind of platform and to not use it to push a message is just a waste.
It's, as you say, it'd be a missed opportunity. And we all just want to make the world a bit better, right? And a bit fairer if we can.
Absolutely.
Do you feel that Scottish identity now, or the world's perception of Scottish identity, marries up with what being a Scottish person is in 2021?
That's a difficult question, because the response that I get to being openly Scottish, if you want to call it that, on a sort of global platform like something like Twitter or TikTok, the ignorance sometimes, and that's not through any fault of anyone's, it's just if you're not taught about things, you don't know about things, but certainly the ignorance of people out with the UK of issues that affect Scotland, it intrigues me, but it also irks me slightly, because, you know, I'll get questions every day like, oh, what clan are you from? Oh, what's your clan tartan? Oh, you know, have you ever seen a Highland coup? Oh, have you, you know, how can I learn? I'll be speaking Scots to them and they'll say, oh, I want to learn my mother tongue of Gaelic. And I'll be like, well, first of all, I'm not speaking Gaelic. And second of all, you don't speak it. Your mother did not speak it. Therefore, it is not your mother tongue.
Yes.
It's not to say you can't learn it and enjoy, you know, all of the fruits of the linguistic community that we have in Scotland, and we will accept you as part of that. But at the same time, there's just this sort of, it's again this need to put Scottish identity in a little box, and if you don't tick these boxes, you're not Scottish. I just think that's bullshit.
Yeah, and it's a very, very dated way of looking at identity.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? So I'm just going to call it now. You are the Poet Laureate of St. Andrew's Society of Los Angeles 2020. So you heard it here first, folks. I believe you will be the Maca of Scotland one day. How would you feel about that?
Oh, God. See, I'd be in two minds. I'd be swithering, because I would love to have that, obviously. It'd be a great honour. It would be a great, phenomenal thing to have a Scots speaking Maca, you know, to you know, I know that the current Maca, she uses Scots in her work, but I'd love to do it. But at the same time, I like to be controversial.
Okay.
In my work. And not for the sake of being controversial, but I like to speak about topics that I think shouldn't be controversial, if that
yes.
makes sense. Things like trans issues, race issues, things like women's issues, you know. And I feel like there would be an inevitable constriction of my work, because, you know, it's a government position. You'd want to be, you know, sticking to what they want you to talk about.
Yeah.
And I feel like you can only really push boundaries if you're completely independent, completely free. If there were a way that I could maintain my complete and utter artistic integrity and do it, I'd love to do it.
I think it'd be
but at
great.
The same time, I think we should have a Gaelic Maca.
Well, yes.
I think we should have a Gaelic Maca as well as a Scots one. I think I just, you know, I can think of so many people who'd be better suited to it than me. That's what the thing is. I'm thinking of all these people that I just, you know, that are much more established poets.
No,
you know, I'm pretty much at the start of my
career.
Don't
put yourself down. Why not? Like, why shouldn't we have a young, brilliant Scots Macla who speaks in Scots? Why shouldn't we? Who's got a brilliant platform and who's intelligent and talented and is very is an advocate for so many subjects that need a platform. I'll vote for you. You've got my vote. Someone who also wrote in the rhyming form was Burns. Are you in any way influenced by him and his work, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole reason that I do poetry is because of Burns, which is frustrating as a young woman, because if you look at, you know, every day it seems to be there's more stuff being uncovered in letters he wrote and things where his character wasn't exactly, you know, progressive or, you know, compatible with the morals that you might hold nowadays. And you can say all you want about it being of the time, but at the same time, there was nobody forcing people to be like that. So it's difficult to reconcile the Burns that I love and the work and the inspiration and the poetic influence with the Burns that I know existed as a real man. But that's, I mean, everyone's heroes are flawed.
Yeah, and it's, you know? I suppose it's about how much we can separate the work and the person, and that's not always possible, actually. I think we've discovered that in recent times. There are certainly people I will never watch on film again.
Absolutely.
After their behaviour. I, similarly, am quite conflicted around Burns. I mean, I adore his work. I think, for me, there's no one else that can use words in the way that he did. And then I read up on him, and sometimes I think, gosh, he felt like one of the sort of first feminists. And then other times I read up and I go, oh, really, he was a bit of a shit to women.
Exactly.
It's very conflicting. I love reading poetry, but I think there is a different nuance when it's performed. I think,
absolutely.
But I think you're a very articulate performer. As an audience member, I often feel that you make me feel what you are saying, you are compelling. And I guess there are some brilliant poets who are not such great performers. Does performing come naturally to you, or do you have to sit at home and rehearse and really work on that side of it?
I have really, really bad social anxiety, and I have always felt that throughout, you know, my life since I was a child. And when I performed at Burns competitions, the judges would sort of remark on my style because I would walk around the stage and nobody else was really doing that. They were all sort of standing still on their mark and just saying the poem, whereas I'd walk around the stage. But I was doing that because my knees were shaking. And if I stood still, there would be a visible representation of my anxiety. So I'd walk to engage my body physically so I wouldn't shake as much. And that's the same with performing. I mean, when I do most of my poetry, it's in my bedroom, it's on my own. And it's generally straight after I've written the poem. Because if I look at the stuff I've written in any real detail, if I rehearse in any real capacity, I'll talk myself out of it, or I'll just delete the whole poem. So I write the poem, I sit down and I read the poem, and that the poem gets read, and then I don't look at the upload until the next day, just in case, you know, because there's always things you could have done better. There's always takes that could have been perfect if you hadn't looked away. Or so, no, I'm not a natural performer in the sense. I'm not a natural writer either. I can't spell.
Really?
So. Oh, absolutely. I mean, people say, oh, I really love your work. No. Yeah. I feel the need to convince myself that I'm shit, but I'm not a natural anything. I don't think you can be a natural. Well, I suppose some people are just naturally gifted, but I'm certainly not one of them.
Well, it doesn't come across like that at all.
I'm glad.
But you said something very insightful there, that you just do like a first take. And I think there's a lesson in that, especially for like actors like myself. In the rehearsal room, I will immediately go with my first instinct, and then I'll go all around the houses. I'll do 40 different things, drive myself crazy, you know, play different tacks, convince myself I'm not getting anywhere with it. And then often I'll come back to the way I was doing
to the first take.
Take, or to the way I was doing it originally. It's like when I go to the shops. I find a top, convince myself there's better things out there, go to every other shop, waste 5 hours, then go back and get it at the end of the day. So maybe let's just go with our first take.
The funny thing is, sometimes when I write, it'll be, you know, if it's a particularly sad poem, it'll be 3 a.m. when I'm having a depressive, you know, episode, and I'll be greeting. There'll be makeup everywhere. And then one time that I filmed that, I was like, I filmed myself with the tears down my face, and I asked the audience, I was like, should I record it as I am now in my natural, just having cried state, or do I put the makeup back on and look all nice for it? The comments were all overwhelmingly, keep the makeup on, do it naturally. So I just performed it, just sobbing, like I had tear tracks all the way down my face, and it just felt so liberating and so raw, because that's what it was. I mean, I wasn't putting the tears on. I had legitimately broken my own heart over this poem, and then I just performed it, and it felt really freeing, because I think there's an expectation of women to be aesthetically pleasing in our sadness. You know, if you see a sort of male directed film and it's got a depressed woman, she'll have the gorgeously, you know, one aesthetic tear dripping yes. down her face as she lounges on the couch in very, very luxurious sweatpants. But that's not what depression looks like.
I really appreciated your honesty watching you online, especially around mental health issues and your own mental health battles. I hope it's okay to ask this. Have you struggled with your mental health for a while?
Oh, definitely. I mean, most of my life, since I was a young teenager, definitely. It's been very difficult, but at the same time, I see it as a good thing, and that's not just through, you know, years and years of therapy. I genuinely do see it as a good thing, because it gives you a degree of empathy that I think. I'm very lucky to have gone through that, because now when my friends are going through similar things, I'm not insensitive to their struggle, because I can empathise with it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it's for a better word, I think the clinical term is shite, but yeah.
And is there certain triggers for you around that, or can it just creep up anytime?
That's the annoying thing, is sometimes your life will be going great, you'll be amazingly happy, but you're not happy mm-hmm. because you're depressed. And I think there's a misconception. People conflate situational depression with chronic depression. And I struggle with chronic depression. So sometimes everything's going absolutely amazingly. You know, you're flying high academically, financially, personally, socially, romantically. And yet you just sit there and think, God, I should really get around to killing myself.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I have suffered from situational depression, but I appreciate that's a very different thing to chronic depression. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my friends, though, who do suffer from chronic depression have talked about the cloud that they just feel coming over them one day.
That's it.
Just out of nowhere.
And you just think to yourself, "What? I must have done something to deserve this." But you haven't. I mean, the minute that you stop blaming yourself for how you feel is quite a freeing time, because then you realise that, God, you might just have a chemical imbalance, or you might just have a brain that messes things up for you sometimes. It's not your fault. No. And, you know, that's what I've tried to explain through the platforms that I have, is the fact that it's okay to feel shit.
Yes.
You will come out the other end, but making sure you come out the other end is the most important thing. It's not about letting people down or performing academically or professionally. The important thing is getting through the shit time and getting back up.
Oh my goodness, yes.
There is still a stigma. I mean, especially when it comes to men mm-hmm. in terms of talking and being open about their feelings. But also in terms of women, I mean, we're supposed to be the mothers. We're supposed to be the daughters that excel. We're supposed to be the sisters that are the confidants. We're not supposed to be, you know, the mess that depression can make you. And I use that term affectionately, because I you know, frequently have been, I mean, I'm just coming out of an episode right now. If you think about the symptoms of depression, that's not what you want women to exhibit. You know, you don't want them to not wash their hair. You don't want them to not brush their teeth. Even now, when you come out, people are very open and honest online, and they come out and tell their stories, you still get the judgment. You know, I put up a post about, I said, I haven't left the bed in a couple of days. And people are like, well, how have you been brushing teeth and washing your hair? And I said, well, I haven't been. And immediately people were saying, you're lazy, you're disgusting. And that's it. That's you wait for it. The empathy has a condition. And the condition is, well, you're allowed to neglect yourself, but only insofar as you don't come across as being lazy or disgusting.
And it doesn't offend them.
Exactly. Then we can shame you.
That is a shocker. As if... What? Oh my goodness.
The like, thing is, when you're...
things in perspective, when people.
When you're trying not to kill yourself, and that's what it feels, it's not... Killing yourself is not an action. It's not one action. It's the culmination of feelings and thoughts and actions. When you're actively trying not to end your life, the last thing you care about is brushing your hair.
Absolutely.
Who gives a shit?
I mean, yes. I mean, you know, just, you know, surely the priority is, or surely what they should appreciate is the struggle to just keep yourself alive. I think that's a bit more important than, you know, putting a brush through your hair. I have had some conversations with people that have blown my mind, talking about a dear friend who sadly did kill herself, and people telling me that, well, it's the most selfish act. Sorry, no, it's not. If these, to me, clearly are people who have never even felt 10% then of what that person felt. I mean, I can understand how your thoughts can take you to wanting to leave this world and feeling there's no other option. But it's definitely, to me, not a selfish thought. People think that they are unburdening others.
Exactly. In the moment, it feels like the most selfless thing you can do because you're relieving other people of your presence, which you feel to be detrimental. And you want to remove yourself from the lives of other people, but also from your own life. And that's why it's so scary, is because your brain is... That's what I always say to people. I say, your brain's a liar. Don't let it be a thief, because it will convince you. It will be the most fervent advocate for your own demise, and it will make it seem like the best option when it's never the best option.
Yeah, another one that I heard recently was someone of an older generation say, don't you think the problem is we're just talking about it too much now, so everybody has mental health issues now because we're just talking about it, and it's an easy excuse. And I lost my shit.
As you should have. I think people have always had them. It's like when you used to have wains that would just wither and die and not eat and eat and not get any better. Now we realise they've got a gluten intolerance. It's not that loads and loads of people are developing gluten intolerances. It's that now we know that they have them. So it's like people now will appear to have more mental health issues, but that's just because they're telling us about them. I hate to blame it on capitalism, but that's what it is. We're conditioned to believe that if we don't contribute every moment of every day, that we don't have any value.
The Cultural Coven is delighted to have musical support from singer-songwriter, musician, member of the Red Hot Chili Pipers, and very importantly, a fifer, Cameron Barnes. This song, Coming Home, and the rest of Cameron's music is available on all the main streaming platforms. So go on, download it and have a wee dance about your kitchen. Thanks, Cameron, for letting us use this tune. The poem that I love that you wrote is about not having children, but having bairns. It really got to me because I, as I spoke about earlier, I grew up feeling a little bit conflicted. My mum was half English, but embraced Scotland, loved being Scottish, loved growing up in Scotland, but her mother had sort of taught her to speak very properly, and so we often didn't use a lot of Scots words in the house, but I heard my dad's family use a lot of Scots. Where did that poem come from?
My mum was talking to me about her class. She's a teacher, and she uses Scots through songs. You know, she's a music teacher, so she'll teach them Ali Bali Bee, and she'll teach them all these poems and songs and things. And then at the same time, she's not really got the space to speak Scots to the children out with the context of songs. So she'll have kids coming in saying, oh, my mum just says this is slang, oh, my dad just says this is bad English. So she just used the songs and helped them to understand the fact that it's not, in a really gentle and sort of, you know, immersive way. So I was talking about that, and I thought, Jesus, if we don't use it, we're going to lose it. And I thought to myself, I need to make sure that I am the kind of mum that I had. So I thought, I'm gonna write a wee thing based on all the things that my mum says. You know, she says that the last line of the poem, you'll be all right, hen, you've got Scots tongue in your head. every day when I was getting bullied, she'd say, "You've got a good stock, Tiny. Away you go and say it. Then you'd be taking on a snash." Like, and it's just, it's things like that. It's wee sayings and things that evoke so much passion in me. And that will always be the poem that I look back on and think, that's me. That's my mum. Like, that's it.
Honestly, I love it. I remember calling my sister through and I was like, "You have to watch this. You have to watch this." Because it's exactly how I feel. It's brilliant. So as we're talking about writing poems, I would like to set you a creative challenge. So the past year has been tough for everyone and for many reasons. And I can testify that it's also been tough if you want to date during this time. So as this episode is coming out just ahead of Valentine's Day, we wanted to ask your thoughts on dating in 2022. So for your creative challenge, we would like you to write a short poem on the realities of dating. It can be as daft or as serious as you like. There's no pressure. It can just be a few lines. I'll just give you a little bit of time and then you let me know when you're ready. Are you ready?
I am indeed. The world's kinda ending, and I'm all alone. All I want is a cohesive plan. Swiping through soulmates for one of my own, my dystopian fictional man. Maintaining his distance 2 meters away while suspense puts me straight into hell. He'd send me a text that would probably say, "You're even more hot, IRL. The ice caps are melting, but so is my heart. There isn't much time, dear, so how about we start to develop this romance out with our two phones, replace notifications with laughter and moans. The global pandemic won't impede our love. You can still hold my hand through a surgical glove. Is a little companionship too much to ask? I don't mind if you kiss me while wearing a mask." He'd rub his hand gently on my vaccine site. "Can we socially distance at dinner tonight? It's hard to find love when you're in a pandemic. All I want is one sensitive, hot, academic. I want one who's firing on every piston with a sexy tight bod and a good immune system. More than anything else, I'm just seeking a friend. We can sit holding hands as we watch the world end. He can tell me I'm pretty. I'll hug him and sigh as the planet's engulfed and we both say goodbye. He'll kiss me with passion and hunger and lips. Fall in love just in time for the apocalypse."
Wait! Oh my goodness, that is so good. And so much of that resonates with me, right? Like, it's funny how the checklist changes. I was like, yeah, I definitely want somebody with a good immune system, COVID-free, a possible surgical glove. And I actually, and then have met someone who is really nice, who happens to be a surgeon. Maybe I'll ask him to wear a surgical glove to hold that.
Awesome.
Were you saying that you've been doing some online dating and met somebody too?
The first date I went on during the pandemic was the BBC filmed it for a news segment.
I didn't know about this.
Yeah, they did. They filmed it. And let me tell you, there's nothing more awkward than a first date, except potentially a first date with a camera crew.
I can imagine. Oh my goodness. Yeah. And is this the person that you are with? Okay.
No. Trust me, that was like five guys. it's been a wild ride because it's true that you don't realise how much you deserve until someone gives it to you.
Oh, that's a lovely way of putting it. But yeah, I think you're right. I had some advice from another actress. She said, don't put down that you're an actress on an online dating profile.
Yeah.
But I wanted to be honest because I just didn't want to appear to lie to someone. I don't think it was a great sort of start. However, I now realise that she was correct in most cases because the first few questions I would get is like, "Do I know you? What have you been in?" Or, "Oh, actually, I saw you in blah, blah, blah. Will you dress up in this costume?" Like, kind of, you know, some sort of strange stuff. How did you manage your profile then? I'm assuming some people would have recognised you.
Yeah, it was weird because people would swipe purely to say, "Oh, I know you, I follow you on TikTok. Yeah, I like Kill Great. Do you want to date me though?" And then I stopped putting poet in my bio because the first thing you get was, write me a poem then. Go on, write me a poem. Or they'd send their poetry, which I'm not going to lie, I do like a guy who can turn a phrase, but genuinely, only if it's not shiny.
Well, that would help.
Like, and I wrote a poem about it, about these men who were just wanting poems. They just want, and I'm like, well, pay me then. Like, I don't do this for, you know, shits and giggles. Like, this is my job. You wouldn't go to a doctor and match with a doctor on Tinder and, like, send him pictures of your weird moles. Like, no, I'm not going to do my job for free.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, yes. And do you feel like that male attention has changed towards you in any way now that your profile has grown?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's disgusting. I hate it. Because it's interesting to see the way that men will view me based on what I wear, how I present myself, or their stage in life. Because 9 times out of 10, men my age will respect mm-hmm. me. They will respect me. They will respect my boundaries. If you say, oh, I don't actually want you to say stuff like that, they'll be like, oh, sorry, I'm so... And that's, I think, we're getting over that sort of hump of toxic masculinity. Whereas a guy in his 50s, you know, last night I got a comment saying, I like your boobs and your hair.
Oh, my God.
That was it. The video in question, I was in a t-shirt and pyjama bottoms. So I'm not... not that there's any excuse. And I think there's a lot of interesting reactions I've got that either sexualise me or infantilise me based on what the guy wants. So it's been a wild ride, especially for someone like me. And I'm quite conservative in the way that I present myself online because I want to be taken seriously, which is sad because I want to live in a world where a woman can... I mean, you've probably seen over the last couple of days that stuff with Jess mm-hmm. Davies and the hate that she's received. And I think she's wonderful because... she pushes such a nice message. I think when I was 12, 13, or even like a young teen, I would have loved to have seen influencers who were like, oh, it's okay to gain weight. Oh, it's okay to have a belly after you eat. That would have saved me a lot of time, hassle, and therapy. So I think that people see women like that and their natural instinct is to tear her down.
I wish we could just live in a world where we can wear whatever we want to wear, be, you know, look whatever way we want to look, and be respected and still be taken seriously. You know, you should dress whatever way you want to, but if you didn't want to dress Absolutely. Conservatively, that's for yourself and not for anyone else. You know, sometimes I will get a message, and just something like you talked about there, from someone who still feels it's appropriate to constantly make comment on appearance, and everything's slightly, there's a sexual undertone. What is that about?
It's annoying because the worst part is when you genuinely feel like you've made a friend, and then they'll slip a wee sexual comment in and you'll say, actually, no, I don't see us that way. And they'll be like, oh, well, what, I'm wasting my time then.
Yeah.
Yes, you are, clearly, and so am I. Away you go.
I know. Like, beat it, right?
It's demoralising because I feel like I have to be upfront and honest with it. And people say I'm going on too much about the misogyny and that, but I want the young women that follow me to be very aware of what's going to happen. Because it's all well and good saying, oh, follow your dreams, have an online presence, be a writer, live your best life. No. Be aware that this is what you'll come up against, Hen. And if I can do anything to counteract that, I will, because I really don't want anyone, because my sense of self has been absolutely destroyed. Mm. You have to create a character in order to not constantly feel like you're being judged, because one time I wore a dress that my dad had got me, and this is a dress my dad had got me, so it's not going to be anything, you know, raunchy. And I got accused of using sex to sell the Scots language.
Oh, God, you can't win, can you? You cannot win with these people. And I think that's what's so admirable about yourself. Obviously, you've created this huge following, but you are relatively, as you said, new into the sort of public eye. But you have been brilliant at just not letting things slide, because I definitely wouldn't have had the confidence to do that when I was in my 20s, definitely.
I think it's because people seem to think that I'm doing this to get as many followers as possible or for money. I have a job. I really could not mm-hmm. care less how many people follow me in the nicest possible way. I'm grateful to every single person. But at the end of the day, if it's 100,000 misogynists, I don't want them following yes. me. So I'm going to piss people off. I'm going to talk about trans issues. If I lose the transphobes, good riddance to bad rubbish. If I talk about women's issues and I lose the misogynists, I don't care. I really do not
exactly,
care.
Exactly, but it's the fact that they think you should, isn't it? It's almost, for me, that's the infuriating thing. You've obviously had quite a large level of trolling, people who just think they know better or can pick on you for whatever their issues are. I experienced trolling on a much smaller scale last year, but I was ill for about 3 days. Myself and my good friend Ashley Smith, who's another actress, we made it was an online commercial for a well-known Scottish football club, And we had done these little sketches called the Malaprop Sisters. So we're speaking in Malaprisms, and it was great. You know, the football club had commissioned us to do something very different. And yes, it was sort of in panto style. It was kind of big. It was in your face. And it was with another very well-known actor. And largely it was well received. But then some people just, it was like this pile on because, you know, we had dared to step into the world of footballing. And
football's a tricky
and
one.
We had, I suppose, dared to sort of challenge the status quo in terms of style of what ads went out there. And I think people, you know, these sort of keyboard warriors, they really don't realise the impact of their words. You could no longer see any of the positive sides or the positive feedback. And I've seen that you've been brilliant at sort of retweeting and challenging these people. But how do you deal with that on a daily basis?
I took a while off because I was... The people around me, they get very worried, as you said. And I'm really sorry that you went through that because I like to think that it's just me sometimes and that I'm just... People just hate me. But it's annoying to see that.
You have so many people who love you as well, though, so...
But that's, as you say, you stop hearing the good stuff because you just... It's like white blood cells only attack the things that are attacking your system. Everything else just passes through the bloodstream. You don't even see it. Oh, you're beautiful. Oh, you're amazing. Great. Phenomenal. You like me. Oh, someone thinks I'm fat. Go. Attack. Like, you know, it's difficult because when you challenge people, sometimes they genuinely don't realise that what they've said is wrong. And then they think the reaction that they get is disproportional. But there's a difference between, as you say, a pile-on and being criticised for what you say. If I come out and said something wildly controversial or nasty or mean, I would expect that the people around me would hold me to a higher standard. Mm-hmm. Whereas when people say, you know, you're a stupid bitch, you're a whore. Someone called me an effing whore.
Wow.
And the thing is, and then people will say I'm insufferable and all that. But when you challenge them and you say, well, what about me is insufferable? What about it? And then they say, oh, you're arrogant. I'm not arrogant. I think I'm shit. I'm on your side, pal. We both think I'm shit. Like, they don't know, they don't see because they've dehumanised you. They think this is someone who's in a position of authority, power. You know, they've got confidence, so they must be untouchable. They don't realise at the end of the day, there's a lassie on the end of the screen that's going to read that and cry.
Yeah.
I greet all the time.
And I think what we sort of came round to realising as well is that either they just genuinely were missing the point or they chose to miss the point because we were actually sending ourselves up. And we weren't in any way trying to mock the football club, you know, quite the opposite. And I think strangely now they've worked out that actually it was one of its most successful ads ever. And there was some great support. Moving on from trolling, you have built a big community online through platforms such as Twitter and TikTok. Yes, you've had a lot of abuse, which horribly did force you to come offline for a while, which I completely understand. But you also, I imagine, have had a lot of support from people rallying to defend you.
It's been mental. I mean, the people that have talked about me and... I mean, Nigella tweeted about
me. Yes, I saw that. That's wild.
I phoned my dad. I was like, Dad, Nigella tweeted about me. Dad, Nigella's talking about me. Dad, did you... And it's just... It's mental because, like, these are people that I've watched on telly. These people like Neil Gaiman. I read his books. Like, it's like, it's been... awesome. It's been surreal as well because you'll see people talking about me and I'll be like, how do you know I exist? How are you real? How are you on Twitter and you see my stuff? Like, oh, it's crazy. And it's just, it's like, it's validating, yes, but it also feeds into this sort of reduced sense of self because I'm like, okay, that's not me. If they only knew the real me, they'd think I'm shit too. So they know Len Penny, they know the poet, they don't know the mess that's, you know, reheating super noodles because she can't be arsed making a dinner for herself. Like,
but you know what, I'm sure Nigella does that once in a while as well. How have the people that you study with at university coped with your growing profile? Have they been supportive?
I mean, as I say, I've done this semester online, so I haven't really spoken to a lot of people. But the pals that I've had, you know, who've messaged me and be like, oh my god, you just showed up on my For You page on TikTok, or oh my god, I've just seen some of your retweeted of yours. They've been so supportive. Aww. It's been nice. It's been really nice, because I was worried that because I had a school voice and a uni voice and a home voice, and I'm now using my podcast voice to be very clear and eloquent, but I was worried that people would think I was putting it on. But people have been... I mean, even when my poem went viral the first time and someone said, you're just putting this on, one of my classmates from primary school messaged the person back and was like, I've known Penny since primary one, and she's always spoken like that.
But I think, particularly people in the arts world, we do tend to be chameleons, because absolutely, I can go on stage and speak in the way I speak at home and, you know, don't pronounce all my T's and all these things. Well, unless my character required that.
Absolutely.
But also, if I am round my friends, I'll speak in a certain way, which is a very different way that I might speak to my doctor, for example. That doesn't mean that you're not being authentic to yourself. We are many things. But people always like to pigeonhole.
And that's the thing. When I do interviews with people and they say, oh, you're not speaking how I thought you would, I'm like, well, who am I speaking to? Have you spoken to me in English? If so, I'm going to respond in English. Is the audience all Scots speakers? If so, I'll probably... Like, the Scots Language Awards, I spoke in Scots the whole time, because the audience... there was an assumed level of literacy within Scots. Yes. At the end of the day, if I make a really witty, clever, salient point, I want as many people as possible to laugh at the joke. And if they don't speak the language, they're not going to find me funny. And then how will I get validation if not through other people?
Oh my goodness, I'm loving this chat. So you do a Scots word of the day, but what is your ultimate favourite Scots word?
Everybody asks this, and I know my friend, Dr. Michael Dempster, he's a Scots academic. He always says the, but I because it's a Scots word. It was used in Scots before it was used in English, so there's a Scots word.
I did not know that.
There's so many words that I love and that I use every day, and that's do I go for a sarcastic answer and say something like weird, which is originally a Scots word, wow, originally a Scots word, the F word, originally a Scots word, or do I just do my actual favourite word, which is boke?
Oh, I love the word boke.
It's so good.
I've got a dry boke.
It's my favourite. The dry boke, because the thing I love about boke is adjective, something's boke, verb, gonna boke, noun, I had a boke.
Yep.
Just on its own, boke.
It's so many things, right?
It's the linguistic, you know, chameleon. I love it so much. I also like curry as well.
Oh, curry's sweet.
Nice.
It sort of lives in the world of Ali Bali B for, you know, kind of for me.
It does. There's nothing you never forget your mommy singing Ali Bali B to, because we used to put our names into the third verse of Ali Bali B. So it would be we lend pennies offy offy thin, rickly bones all covered with.
I'm gonna have to take that one. That's lovely. I didn't know you really could
so
do that.
Sweet.
You were talking about going into schools, and I believe you've done some work around raising awareness around climate change. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Climate Tales, that was a competition for Wayne's writing competition, and I was able to go and meet the finalists and see them get their wee trophies and hear their... It was class. It was amazing. The thing I loved the most was the fact that, like, everyone talks down to Wayne's. Everyone thinks they're stupid. Everyone thinks they're ignorant. And these kids were putting, like, everyone on blast. They were like... This is the problem. We know this is the problem. Why are you not fixing this? You know, some kid, they had to edit it out of the second run because they were like, you know, someone must have pulled him aside and been like, tone it down, mate. Because he came out and was basically like, capitalism's the problem. These billionaires need to be killed. And I was like, yes man,
for
come
president,
on.
Pal. Oh my goodness.
Because the kids know.
Yeah.
They know everything that's going on.
I have really observed recently how savvy children are around climate change. And obviously we've got people like Greta Thunberg, who's been doing some brilliant work about raising awareness around that issue. And also I think she's very relatable for people as well.
Oh, yeah.
But kids have...
Talk about trolling.
Oh yeah, well, horrendous.
Jesus.
I mean, that's just a whole other can of worms. I do not understand why... You would find a problem with trying to save, you know, the world.
She seems like such a lovely wee lassie as well.
Like, she seems so genuine, and she's, like, having so much fun when she was going to all the climate change things, and it's like, I think we need more people like that in the world.
Yeah.
And you won't get more people like that if you continually tear them down.
Exactly. Some, you know, a girl who's trying to do something positive, and not just for, no, not for herself, for the world and for future generations.
Exactly.
And then these people want to attack her. God, but what the great thing is, I think, obviously we teach about climate change in schools, but I think people like Greta have really opened the eyes of many people, and particularly of a very young generation. I notice, like, my friends' children, the way they talk about things, they have way more knowledge than I do around what we should be doing, you know, to preserve the environment and whatnot. Were you quite blown away then by the children's knowledge?
Absolutely. And I think the reason that people of our generation were maybe less vocal and less switched on from an early age is because the messaging that we got was that it was all our fault. We got, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle. How many times does your family flush the toilet? Yep. You know, how many bottles of water do you buy a week? All about personal responsibility and less about, you know, collective responsibility and the fact that it is these governments, these fast fashion companies, these, you know, these people who are pumping hundreds and hundreds of tons of crap into the water, and it's not even us. Like, we can live a good, healthy, sustainable life, not saying that we shouldn't, but we can do everything that we want, but until we make, you know, governmental change on a systemic level, we're not going to be able to change things. And that's what was coming across in the Wayne's work, is the fact that they know this. They've switched themselves off to this reduce, reuse, recycle bullshit. Mm-hmm. Because they are so aware, because of people like Greta, of the fact that no, it's not us, it's all of us. Not
yes.
just the people, but the companies.
It's not just the individual, is it? Obviously we can make a difference in our own little way, but these big sort of multinational companies and consumers, they have to make change.
Yes.
It's time. Thinking back to when you were talking about being at school there, when I was at school, even though I loved reading poetry, I didn't really make it known because it wasn't really something that was kind of cool, or I suppose I was aware
yeah.
that I might have been bullied for it.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a love of poetry at school? And if you did, were you able to make that known?
I did have a love of poetry. I did not make it known, because when I started to make the Burns stuff known, that come across as quite quote-unquote cringy and quite, you know, Wayne's just, anything that deviates from the norm is a bit weird. But, I mean, it didn't deter me, and it certainly, I think, that's why I like going into schools and talking to them, because it's not like, hey kids, poetry's cool, but it's like, hey, this is a valid career option for you. Like, I am a working poet. I write poetry and I get paid to do it. This is, you know, because when people come in and talk, it's always the doctors and the lawyers and the teachers that come in and talk to you on career day, and, you know, you go work experience with your dad. But I never got an opportunity to see a real creative, to see someone come in and be like, look, the creative industry is valid, you know?
Yes.
And I feel like we should do more to excite ourselves about the creative industry, because Scottish creative, and, you know, it's amazing. It's phenomenal. Think of all the stuff that we've done in the last couple of years.
Absolutely. And it's so diverse as well. I think there's something for everyone. Whether, you know, you like to read books, or you like to go to the theatre, or you like to read poetry. We have so much as a country to offer, I think. And you're right, kids naturally want to... anything that deviates from the norm is not always accepted. However, I will say that I have been heartened by generations like my nieces, who are teenagers, who are very accepting of a friend at school coming out, for example, as being gay.
Oh, absolutely.
When I was at school, you would really have been bullied for something like that.
I think that just shows that bigotry is a learned behaviour. I mean, 9 times out of 10, I've spoken to quite a few young people, and they'll be like, oh, my pals come out as non-binary, and I'll be like, oh, cool, what's their name? And they'll be like, oh, their name is this. It's so easy. So as soon as it's just that, it's like, okay, this is a thing that is real. Oh, my pal wants to go by gender neutral pronouns, or my pal wants to go by feminine pronouns now. Fine, cool, we'll do that. And it's like, I love it.
I love seeing it because that's just proof that the education's working. Yes. Because within a few generations, we will look at sort of things like transphobia, the way that we look at homophobia now is sort of a relic of the past.
Yeah.
And something that we actively as a society, when we see homophobic people now, everyone's sort of like, that's, I think we can all agree that's bullshit. Whereas now I think there's a sort of the last gasp of transphobia in this country that we need to sort of eradicate. Because, you know, my trans pals, I think they're heartened, as you say, by the fact that the younger generation are not learning bigotry as quickly as the older generation would like.
Yeah, and actually, I have been very proud of some of the action that the Scottish Government have taken in terms of teaching in schools around these subjects. I think they have been leading the way on some of these things, and I applaud it. I welcome it.
It's these things that we do at a grassroots level in schools that we will see the benefits of. And whether that's things like Gaelic or Scots, whether that's things like inclusive education, even things, you know, teaching kids about the true history, you know, not the whitewashed history and then what actually happened with colonisation and things like that. We will reap the benefits of that in generations to come, because the good thing about bigotry is you can learn it, but you can also unlearn it. You can also teach people the true, you know, the true way to treat people and the true way to accept people. And I feel like the more that we teach Wayans, the more tools we give them in the fight against bigotry, the more they will feel confident enough to accept themselves.
Yeah. And let's not pretend that Scotland was or is perfect.
No, obviously.
Yeah, we have parts of our history that we shouldn't be proud of, but also we should teach about that, because if we teach people about that, then hopefully we don't repeat mistakes of the past.
Absolutely. The only way you can overcome a problem is if you acknowledge it in the first place. And if you bury your head in the sand, you're never going to make any progress.
Exactly. Okay, on that note, I think I'm going to move on to the quick fire questions. So Len, I always tell people these are the fundamentals on which I judge a person. So I've been doing a lot of talking about not judging people, but these are quite lighthearted. So I'll judge your choices on these. So I'm going to give you two options, and if you could just fire back with your instinctive answer, okay?
Okay.
Are you ready?
I am indeed.
TV or theatre?
TV.
Sin or virtue?
Sin.
Chippy sauce or no chippy sauce?
No chippy sauce, that's heinous.
Sorry. Oh, you're getting banned from coming to Edinburgh. That's, I'm not inviting you to the theatre.
Sorry, I'll watch the telly.
True crime or fiction?
True crime fiction.
Ooh. Land or sea?
I can't swim, so land.
Highlands or lowlands?
Lowlands.
The Bard or Burns?
Burns, obviously.
Fancy Nancy or Dress Down?
Fancy Nancy.
Tunnock's Tea Cake or Tunnock's Caramel Wafer?
Tunnock's Tea Cake, because I like my teeth.
Sonnet or haiku?
Sonnet.
Liz Lockhead or Carol Ann Duffy?
Liz Lockhead, every single time. No offence.
Cake or quinoa?
Cake. Who? I want to know who said quinoa. Give me their names.
Do you know what? I don't think we've had anybody yet, thank goodness, because I would have just been deleting straight away. Twitter or TikTok?
Oh, TikTok.
Iron Brew or whiskey?
I'm teetotal, so Iron Brew.
Highland Dancing or Highland Coos?
Highland Coos, Highland Dancing.
Why not, eh? Haggis or Tatty Scone?
I've never had haggis, so Tatty Scone.
You've never had haggis?
No.
And you do Burns?
Okay, I've been a lot of Burns suppers, but I just covertly slide it to the person next to me and they eat my haggis.
Are you scared of it?
I kind of. Gives me the fear.
Does it give you the boke?
It actually does, because it's like, it looks like brains.
Oh. I know, yeah, I used to be...
And as a Wayne, I was like, no, that's heinous, that's not happening.
I used to be scared of it when I was little, but honestly, once you try it, you won't go back. It's very nice. What about a veggie option?
I don't know. It gives me the fear. Just texturally looks like it's wrong.
Would you roll about in a bath of it for children in need? Would you go swimming in a bath of haggis?
That was such a waste of food. That was so disrespectful to the children in need. Look at this flagrant waste of the food you don't have.
Oh, well, yeah, actually, maybe not.
Never had black pudding either.
Never had black pudding. Oh, no. Goodness. I'm going to have to send you a parcel. And just...
No chippy sauce in
no,
it.
No, 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 yeah. Classics or contemporary?
Contemporary.
And that concludes the quick fire questions. Well, thank you, Len, so much for coming and chatting to me. It has been joyful. You have been so insightful, inspiring. I just love your work, and it's just been lovely to be in your company. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I hope to maybe see you in person when the pandemic is over, or when it's safe to travel, and I can shake your hand and not have the fear.
You bring the haggis.
Yay! Chippy sauce through it.
Bulk.
Thank you. Bye. What a talented and inspiring woman. It was lovely to have Len in the coven, and I am so very grateful for her honesty, and I just loved that poem she did. Thank you to you for joining us in the coven. Please do remember to leave a wee review if you're enjoying the conversations, and to subscribe so you never miss an episode. As you know, we are in association with the Lyceum Theatre in Edinburgh, and they reopen on the 25th of February with a play called The Scent of Roses, written and directed by Zinnie Harris. The Scent of Roses begins with a wife who decides to take her husband hostage to finally have an honest conversation, so it sounds fascinating. And the cast of five also feature two of our previous guests, the brilliant Maureen Beattie and Saskia Ashdown, and the play's also led by the wonderful actor Peter Forbes. I can't wait to see this play, so do get along if you can. We're now going to have a little bit of a break, but we will be back with a special eighth guest to end the season. There will be a little bit of a gap due to the guest commitments, but trust me, it will be well worth the wait. Hope you have a great week. It's bye for now from me, Nicola Roy. The Cultural Coven is brought to you in association with the Stephen Dunn Theatre Fund and the Lyceum Theatre, co-created by me, Nicola Roy, produced by Lee Kennedy, with sound engineering and editing by Barry McCall, and musical support from Cameron Barnes.